طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Welcome to another edition of This Week in Palestine, a weekly show hosted for many years by Sharif Pham and continued in his loving memory by a group of his dedicated friends. Every week, This Week in Palestine brings you news and views from a decidedly Palestinian perspective, a perspective seldom heard in the United States. This Week in Palestine is produced by Despina Moutsouris. This is John Roberts. One of the major stories following the elections in Israel was the election of 14 Arabs to the Knesset, who have coalesced into what they call the Joint List Party, now the third largest party in Israel. Many wonder how they will spend their currency, but this Mondo Weiss news story tells us that they intend not to be silent. Joint List Party head Amen Odeh campaigned for Israeli elections like a troubadour. He went town to town speaking of civil rights for Palestinian citizens of Israel, often quoting poets and peaceniks alike, even the Hebrew Bible. Now Odeh is bringing the goods to Jerusalem. While Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in the final hours of forming a ruling coalition to lead the country, Odeh's group is organizing a mass march. Unrecognized villagers in the Negev will camp and walk their way to Israel's seat of government, all while their party's leadership is tightening ties with presumed opposition heads in the Zionist camp. Riding off their high voter turnout momentum, up 10% from 2013, the Joint List asks constituents today to join them on a four-day mass march from the southern Negev region to Jerusalem, President Reuven Rivlin's house, to be precise. The Joint List chooses to open its first term in the Knesset with a march for recognition, to raise awareness of the unbearable reality of life for the residents of the unrecognized villages, the Joint List said in a statement. Once in Jerusalem on the president's doorstep, the Joint List will submit a blueprint for bringing legal status to the 80,000 Bedouins in shanty towns that pepper the desert. The Joint List said the plans are a professional and realistic way to recognize and develop all 46 villages, which will benefit the entire population of the Negev, Arab and Jewish, and contribute to the development and regeneration of the Negev. Moreover, Rivlin, the target, has been an outspoken advocate for the rights of Bedouins since taking office last year. Negev Bedouins have the highest poverty rates and the worst living conditions in Israel. Their homes are made up of tin and tarps, more often than not adjacent to open sewer and waste from one of the desert's many factories. While their townships are deemed illegal by the state because they were built without difficult-to-obtain permits, the government has recognized the special status of Bedouins as indigenous peoples to the land. They are the salt of the earth, yet so excluded from the privileges of being an Israeli citizen that their housing and lifestyle are more akin to stateless West Bank Palestinians than Jewish Israelis who reside nearby. This demonstration, the Joint List's first project as a newly formed bloc, comes in lieu of participating in the horse race for minister positions. Nearly every other party is bidding for a trade-off from Netanyahu. The Jewish Home Party is demanding top billing in the ruling coalition, flexing their power to solicit seats that would otherwise go to the Likud victors. The Joint List didn't bother to enter the fray. Instead, the Joint List is trying to forge a relationship with a rival Zionist camp and its leader, Isaac Herzog. Actually, it is the lesser of two evils. On today's show, we feature a heartfelt and poignant interview with Palestinian-American poet Naomi Shihab Nye and her father, Azib Shihab, discussing his return to Palestine and his book, Does the Land Remember Me? The show was recorded June 2007 on a program called Deep in the Heart that originated in San Antonio, Texas, and was hosted by Ann Helpke. Aziz died October 22, 2007, several months after this interview. Aziz Shihab was born in Jerusalem in 1925. He became a journalist during the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in 1947-1948. And worked for the BBC. In 1950, Aziz emigrated to the United States with his parents. After attending the University of Kansas, he moved to St. Louis, where he continued to practice journalism, working for several newspapers such as the St. Louis Globe Democrat, the San Antonio Express, and the Dallas Morning News. In 1998, Aziz started his own newspaper, the Arab Star, based in Richardson, Texas. He also published two books, A Taste of Palestine and Does the Land Remember Me? Aziz loved writing, journalism, and the truth. He was a firm believer in justice for Palestine and oft-times served as a mentor to young Arabs pursuing a career in journalism and writing. Here is that original interview as broadcast on the radio program Deep in the Heart in San Antonio, Texas.
Welcome to Deep in the Heart, from deep in the heart of Texas, San Antonio. I'm Ann Helmke, and I direct the Peace Center here, and it's good to have you with us again today. It is our hope in Deep in the Heart that whoever's watching this filming and this program, that you'll know that there are people in the United States, and people specifically in Texas, who are committed to peace and justice, and who work all the time in terms of nonviolence and education, speaking around the United States, writing books, making documentaries, forming organizations. We plan to interview people from San Antonio and anybody who's traveling through. And today we're really fortunate because we have someone from San Antonio and we also have someone who's traveling through. So we're looking forward to hearing from both Aziz Shihab and his daughter Naomi Shihab Nye. Aziz Shihab left his native Palestine in 1950 to study journalism. He married an American and had two children, then settled in St. Louis, where he had a distinguished journalism career. In 1993, his brother wrote him about his mother's health and her pending death, and so he went back to be with her. His latest book, Does the Land Remember Me?, is a memoir from his time spent there. And we hope to hear a little bit about that today. It was during that time, those optimistic days following the signing of the Oslo Accords. He now lives in Dallas. We also have with us today his daughter, so we're doubly fortunate this day, Naomi Shihab Nye. She likes to describe herself as a wandering poet, and we like to call her our poet because she lives here in San Antonio. When she was 14, her father packed up the family, and they moved to Jerusalem, where they lived for a year. Naomi has written a couple books about that experience, City's Secrets, which is a children's story about her grandmother, who actually died at the age of beautiful 106 years, and also Habibi, which is a young adult novel, which has won numerous literary awards. So we're really grateful that you're both with us today, and we have kind of a living legacy sitting here with us. And so we're just very excited about hearing about your experiences and your work. Naomi, your father starts his new book with your poem, Jerusalem from 19 Varieties of Gazelle, your book as well. Would you mind indulging us and reading that poem for us?
Thank you so much. I'm honored to read it and honored to be here with you, Anne, and with my dear dad. The poem has a quote from the Swedish poet Tommy Olofsson at the top. He wrote, "Let's be the same wound if we must bleed. Let's fight side by side, even if the enemy is ourselves. I am yours, you are mine." Jerusalem. I'm not interested in who suffered the most. I'm interested in people getting over it. Once, when my father was a boy, a stone hit him on the head. Hair would never grow there. Our fingers found the tender spot and its riddle. The boy who has fallen stands up. A bucket of pears in his mother's doorway welcomes him home. The pears are not crying. Later, his friend who threw the stone says he was aiming at a bird. And my father starts growing wings. Each carries a tender spot, something our lives forgot to give us. A man builds a house and says, "I am native now." A woman speaks to a tree in place of her son, and olives come. A child's poem says, "I don't like wars, they end up with monuments." He's painting a bird with wings wide enough to cover two roofs at once. Why are we so monumentally slow? Soldiers stalk a pharmacy. Big guns, little pills. If you tilt your head just slightly, it's ridiculous. There's a place in this brain where hate won't grow. I touch its riddle, wind, and seeds. Something pokes us as we sleep. It's late, but everything comes next.
Aziz, do you like listening to her poetry as much as
Every
we do?
Every time I listen to Naomi, I get very moved. There were times when I really had tears.
Mm-hmm. Do you write poetry as well?
No, I'm afraid not. I'm having a hard time writing prose.
So where did she get that?
I guess from God.
From God. I just love listening to her read.
Yeah. Oh, that's very sweet of you. But I think I got it partly from the attention paid to voices in our house when I was growing up, because our father told us stories before we went to sleep every night, and we loved his stories. They were something delicious to look forward to, even for kids who didn't want to go to bed. We knew that the stories would be coming, and that was a great pleasure. And our mother read to us, and especially to me, once she discovered my appetite for it, she read poems. This is before I could read myself. And I just loved that clear attention to language, both in story and in poem. And and so I felt that in our household there was a care about words and grammar and description, how to tell a story so that someone would calm down, settle, and listen to it. That was very much part of the atmosphere. So, you know, I think that helped make me a poet at a young age.
And speaking of stories, Aziz, would you tell us the story behind the title of your book, Does the Land Remember Me?
Well, it's Naomi's son who gave me the title. And he was at the time, what?
About 12.
We were in Naomi's house, and I had the idea of a book. And we started talking about, what would you name it? And he just looked and he said, "Does the land remember me?" I was talking to them about the land and my struggle with the land and so on. Because I have been almost obsessed with buying land in Texas to replace the land I lost, or I thought I was going to lose there, and I lost there, my father rather. So he said, he gave us that, and it stuck with me, and when I started writing the book, I thought, what better title? And that's where it came from.
From a 12-year-old.
From 12-year-old. But fits in so well, really. The land, I think, is the main problem in Palestine. And the more I think about it, the more I think the wars that are happening there now, especially in Palestine, are recent wars. They are not ancient wars, as televangelists like to tell you, or as Jewish people like to tell you. I think it's a new war. It's a war that started in 1948, and it's a war about land and the ownership of the of land there, and greed. And when I was writing the book, you know, to tell you why I started writing the book, when I first came to this country, I was speaking to a Rotary Club in Kansas. I used to do a lot of speaking on the Middle East. And the man who introduced me said that now we hear from a good Muslim. I said, Muslim? He wanted to say Muslim.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Then I thought, well, it's probably because of his ignorance, until I found out later that he was a minister of a church. I thought he ought to know better. But that stayed with me for so long, and I found out that that mistake is often not said because of ignorance, but it's said because they wanted to attack Islam or the Muslim religion. And for some 30 years, I didn't do much about it, even though I worked most of that time with newspapers. I also found out that newspaper people do it purposely. The first board meeting of a newspaper I attended when I was the news editor of that paper, there was a man who was 26 years with that newspaper, and he kept referring to the Arabs as Arabs. Finally, I said, John, there is no such thing. There is no Arabs. He said, I'm just joking. I said, you don't joke about people. And I was new, and of course everybody laughed, and the editor of the paper said to him, don't do that anymore. But he was doing it out of, I think, an attack on the Arab people. And when I started thinking of this book seriously, when I made the trip, I thought I haven't really done much in the United States to correct people other than a few incidents like this one I just mentioned. So the main purpose of the book was, hopefully, that my new people, the American people, the people I adopted to be my people after I left Palestine, need to know better, need to know more. And until this day, I'm always amazed when they bring all these experts and specialists from television who really know almost nothing about Islam or the Arabs or about truly what happened in Palestine. And I felt if I need to contribute anything, I really should write stories that maybe will enlighten my American friends, my American brothers, to the facts of what's happening there since 1948. And this is why I talked to people on both sides when I was traveling there, and we explored a lot of conversations, and I wrote everything as a story to bring it down to the level of people who don't want to get involved in politics or maybe don't care about talking about politics. But maybe they read about these people and read about them smoking in taxi cabs that say no smoking, or still thinking of ancient customs. And one of my favorites really was spending a day in a Bedouin tent. And that was the suggestion of a friend of mine who said, you know, the Bedouins are, I think, the most honest people in the Middle East. They will tell it as it is. they will tell you, they will not exaggerate. They will tell you what they believe and they will feel. And they sure did. They did. And then just being with normal, simple people, and I wanted to carry the story. And I ended up being friend of some Israelis who, when I was entering Palestine from Jordan, were very nasty to me, very mean. Well, they took me to a room and asked me to get naked, and they x-rayed my shoes, and they searched me, and I kept asking, why are you afraid of me? I'm only a journalist, you know. And I met these people on roadblocks, on inspection stations, where they humiliate the Arabs, where the Israelis humiliate the Arabs, and where the Arabs suffer in silence, because they do nothing. And I began to really feel the huge burden of occupation, what occupation does to people. I lived under occupation as a child, under the British. I felt it a little at the time. As a child, you don't feel as much as you feel when you are older. But I began to feel what these people are going through, and I wanted to tell their story. Then I went into a Jewish home, and after I ate with them, there is a custom there where they say, now we broke bread together, like the father of this man, who, an officer who humiliated me at the Jordan Bridge, said, now I broke bread with you, you are like my brother, you are like my son, I can't lie to you, when I asked him a question. And my question was really simple. You were living in Iraq, and I hear you were well-to-do there, and you had stores. Why did you move and come here? Did the Iraqis throw you out? He said, no, no. At the time, I thought they did, because we had stones thrown at our windows to break the glass. We had people attacking us in the street, and we thought it was Iraqis. But I have to be honest with you. Now I discover that it wasn't. It was Zionists, Israelis, who needed more people to carry guns in Palestine to fight. And they are the ones who did this to us so we can run out of Iraq. And I am here, and I'm sorry I am here. I don't want to be here. But this family are my friends. They were when I met them, after I met them, and they are friends now. And I met others who knew me, who knew Naomi and other Jewish people. I met a man who I knew from what his wife said that he worked for the Mossad or the Israeli Secret Service. Because when I asked his wife for pictures of my family that this man had taken there, she jokingly said, she said it was a joke, I can't do it, I have to get permission from the Mossad. I said, Mossad, you work for the Mossad? She said, all of us work for the Mossad. Well, I understood that they were also under pressure to do some duties. But my hope in writing the book, to be brief again, is to do something that I should have done every day of my 56 years in America. And that is that the man in the street in San Antonio or Dallas or New York knows exactly what happened to us. I mean, there is a Brooklyn family living in my home. They occupied it with a gun. And I asked Jewish people, I spoke to a Zionist group in Houston one time, and a man said to me, why are you so angry with the Zionists? I said, would you like anybody to occupy your home? He said, no. I said, please think of that then, why I am angry. And then another says, why are you angry with the Jews? I said, I'm never angry with the Jews. The Jews are my friend. I am angry with the Zionists who occupied my home. I think the whole idea repulses me. And whether it's in Palestine or anywhere else in the world, it's just not time for anybody ever to go back and say so many thousands of years ago, this used to be my home. And it's not right to say, God gave me this and God gave me that. God is not in the real estate business. God doesn't prefer any of his children over others. So I am hoping that if anything, that this book will teach my American friends and non-friends of what happened and that they would work for peace. This is why I say this is a gift. This book is a gift to the Israelis who work for peace and the Arabs who work for peace and truly work for peace. The Arabs, unfortunately, can do it. When you are under occupation, when you don't even carry a knife over 2 inches long or 3 inches, whatever it is, the rule, you can't really do much for peace. You just try to live from day to day and survive and keep your pride. So there isn't much they can do. The Israelis and the Americans can do it. I am doing another book now about my life in America. And believe it or not, one of the working titles that I started thinking about wanted to say, In the Home of My Enemy. Because I felt that without the United States, Israel would not be where it is. And you know, we have a saying in Arabic, the friend of my enemy is my enemy. And without the U.S. today, Israel cannot survive long. And somebody asked me yesterday, I think it was yesterday, how can these people get together and have peace there? I said it without hesitancy. Get out of there. Let the American people get out of there. You put 2 people together there. We are a nomadic tribe there. And nomadic tribes believe in 2 things very strongly. Revenge and forgiveness. That is the 2 main things that the Bedouins believe in. When I was a child, I remember a man coming and running in the basement of our house. And I asked, what's this man doing? They said he just had a fight with a man, and with a knife he hurt the man. We don't know if he killed him or not, but he is hiding. And my father went down in the basement and asked him, what's going on? And he came out. He said he hurt so-and-so, who was another member of the family. They were both of the family. And I said, well, how are you going to solve that? Because my father was known as a mediator, as a peacemaker, or as a mukhtar, like mayor. He was not a mayor, but that's what they gave him a title of. And he said, it's very simple. All this man has to do is go to this man's family's home and ask forgiveness, and nothing would happen. And sure enough, we didn't believe it at the time. He took this man to his home, and he told him to take his head dress, because that shows that he is so humbled, and so sad, and so sorry, and asks and begs for forgiveness. And he took his head dress, stepped on it, and while he's asking for forgiveness from the people, and the people said, you're forgiven. That's what the Bedouins do. And today, if they really leave these people together, the Israelis and the Palestinians, Hamas and the PLO, the Shiites and the Sunnis, and all the other groups, we are agitating them. Leave them alone. They'll get together. They'll ask for forgiveness. And they know they are Bedouins, and they will have peace if you just get out of there. This was my goal in that book.
When you're traveling with the book and meeting with different groups, and since your hope is so that people can hear the stories and come to some understanding, what's the response been from people that you've been meeting with those stories?
Well, I can give you the most recent example. Yesterday, I had a signing for the book here in San Antonio, and we had an overwhelming audience, I mean, larger than I anticipated. And the bookstore ran out of the book.
You know, it's because we love your daughter.
Oh, I know. I know, and she's a miracle worker. Mm-hmm. She really is. But I think people agree with me. I think people want to read it, and I have had many excellent reviews. from people who didn't know me and people who knew me. And they say, well, you are telling them what you believe and keep doing it. And who knows? Who knows? You know, when I started thinking of writing this, there was no problem with Saddam. There was no problem with Bush. There was none of this. And I wasn't thinking of any of this. I just wanted to tell any American I meet, because these are my people now. I don't have a Palestinians to be my people. I replaced them. I adopted new people. I want them to know the facts, please. Do you know that a Brooklyn family lives in my home? They say, what? But a Brooklyn family, why did they come? They didn't need a home. I said, yeah, I wish they gave me their home in Brooklyn. Now, you know. And there is a good, positive response. And I am hoping that it will bring peace.
Do people have lots of questions? Do they seem open to...
A lot of questions. I think the American people are the kindest people in the world. Individually, and when you leave Washington, when you don't talk politics, you have the best people in the world. You really do. They have good hearts. I always said, I spoke one time in Jerusalem to a club there, and I was praising the American people, and they said, you have been brainwashed. I said, I am brainwashed, because I know these people. They have good hearts. One of the first people to almost adopt me in this country was an American Jewish family in St. Louis. We became very close friends. You know, but when I said to them, look, I don't dislike Jews, I dislike Zionism. The man said to me, I dislike Zionism too. And we became friends. Mm-hmm. And he arranged for me to go and testify before a Senate subcommittee on Palestine. So I have a lot of Jewish friends and non-Jewish.
Mm-hmm. Aziz, it seems to me in your storytelling and in your writing, you're mediating a lot like your father did. And Naomi, I know that your grandmother played a significant role in your life. Could you maybe tell us a little bit more about that relationship and that bonding?
She had a great charisma, and people who came around her just loved her or felt they were part of her spell and her presence. And I think she functioned, many people have told me, she functioned as a kind of mediator as well in the village. And if someone had a problem, any kind of problem, a marital problem, a problem with their child, they would often come and sit in her presence in the evening, cracking almonds around the fire, and tell their problem, talk about it, and she would, you know, come up with some pithy philosophical story or some sort of metaphor to help them see their way through it. I think she had that gift. I think that people who like stories and poems and believe in them as vehicles for, you know, further connection in our world, I think we get sort of addicted to that. I would disagree with something my dad said, though, when he said, to write a story is to kind of come down from politics. I actually think to write a story is to go up from politics. Mm. I think literature is a higher level of language communication than the language of politics, which is often so didactic and rhetorical and hollow and, you know, full of stances, you know, just vague, weird things that people say in politics that you couldn't get away with in a story. Mm-hmm. A story would say, huh? What do you mean by that? What picture does that give me? How could that be true? So to me, writing stories, even if they are simple stories of simple people, is a level up of, above politics, not coming down.
I even kind of find it to be radical politics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Much more
I
radical,
think so.
More subversive. You can gain some ground.
Right, and it's very easy to reject stances, you know, to say, that's not true, this is true. But you don't reject stories. Like, you don't say to someone else, well, I don't believe you lived that, or I don't believe you saw that. People don't reject in the same way. So there's also a kind of embracing a possibility with storytelling, with films. I think of a lot of films that have come out of the Middle East in recent years, and how they might be incredible vehicles for deeper thinking than anyone's political language could be. And they involve images, scenes, characters, plot, dialogue, you know, all the things that are involved in stories.
I think what intrigues me the most of about having you both here is your legacy, your work, but mostly your legacy, and how you're leaving something to the world. And in terms of your family as well, how do you go about that? Has that been intentional, or are you conscious that you do that?
Well, hopefully they write what we, they read what we write. That's one thing. And I want to leave with a listener, if you have any listeners, I hope you do, that I had the idea for the book, but when I was in dialysis, kidney dialysis, first day I walked into a dialysis clinic, and I saw the people suffering. Actually, some people were shouting with pain, some people were angry, and some people were arguing. And I walked in that clinic, I said, no, I can't. There is no way I can live this life. So I started thinking about it the first half an hour in the clinic, and I thought, I want to finish this book. I started thinking about it the first half an hour in the clinic, and I thought, I want to finish this book before I die. I was literally afraid, because I didn't know much about dialysis, which I'm still undergoing. I'm going to die within a few weeks. I want to finish this book. This will be what I can contribute to anybody here who doesn't know what I suffered, what my people have suffered, and still suffering. And I began writing during the clinic. I will not get involved in conversation with anyone. And the doctor there and the nurses thought, well, this is good therapy for him. I said, hey, listen, I'm not writing this for therapy, for me. I am writing this to finish a project that I hope I can contribute to people. You know, this is the reason I'm writing it. And I finished this, thank God, during dialysis. And it uplifted my spirit while I'm doing it. Every day I finish a few pages, I go home, I put them in the computer, and it made me feel so much better that I was anxious to go to the clinic 2 days later. So I think it uplifted the spirit of many of the patients there when they knew what I was doing, because the nurses would tell them, don't bother him, he's writing, don't bother him, he's a writer, he's writing, you know. So this is, we hope that people would read that and it would uplift their spirits, whatever they are going through. We hope that they can be optimistic about life and maybe need a little fear of dying soon to finish the projects they should be working on, you know?
Well, back to your question about legacy. And you know, I think as writer, I always felt the legacy of a reader, you know, because I love to read so much, and even as a child, being an obsessive reader, that part of the ongoing family is, you know, reader to writer to reader to writer, and if you love to read, then why not share your work, because you're just passing it on to a potential other reader who's a human being like you. But at this point in my life, I'm really interested in issues of disconnection and connection, and how many families, like even local families, families who don't have any overseas immigration issues at stake, who don't have any kind of legacies of injustice in their people's history, although maybe all people have that, how many families have a kind of essential disconnection within them, and how much reading can or can't help, or reading other stories like your story, how much that can help you understand your own story. One of my favorite quotes was, a few years ago I was doing a workshop with teachers in Canada, and this teacher at the end of the day, who hadn't spoken all day, she'd been very discreet in the corner, she suddenly raised her hand and wanted to read, and she came forward, and she, this is just a paraphrase, because I never got a copy of the poem, because after she said this, she left the room and none of us saw her again. We couldn't even thank her. But basically what she said was, I always looked down on the Arabs and the Jews. And she didn't seem like she was either Arab or Jewish, but she said, I always looked down on the Arabs and the Jews. I thought, why can't they get their act together? Why can't they make peace? Why can't they figure out a way for understanding? But then I experienced the most contentious divorce in the history of Canada. And I had to ask myself, why can't I get it together with the one person I know best in the world? But I couldn't. So, and then there was some more of the poem, but it ended with, "So I will never again look down on the Arabs and the Jews." And she ran out of that place, and I looked around. Everybody had been in there all day. We were exhausted. Was weeping. And there was this sense of, what an honest disclosure. And then we got in a great conversation at the end of the day just about issues of, well, what are we all doing here anyway? We're writing because we want to connect to things that matter to us. Here she was able to stand up, a shy person, stand up and read this, something very deep from her heart, and very connected to things we can continue to think about in the world. How many of us, I just asked out of curiosity, how many of us have people we don't speak to in our own families? Every hand went up. Every single person had someone. And so that the day kind of ending with, well, part of our jobs as teachers, as writers, as believers in language, is to keep trying to communicate with the people who don't necessarily want to hear from us or who aren't expecting to hear from us. And, you know, I think as a writer, you know, there is that sense in families that we can pass on things that we share that make us feel connected. But we're also always working with very basic issues of disconnection and how may we use the tool, the vehicle of writing, to make some bridge, wherever it might be. I mean, I've been working in school so long that I am a 1,000% believer in how much this simple act of writing can help people of any age, people with any level of, you know, experience, connect to things which matter to them. So,
anyway. Aziz, I'm wondering if, before we finish, you could read us a passage from your book.
Of course, of course.
We can kind of bookend our times with,
of course,
Shehab readings.
All right. After I came to the United States, Mother took care of the Lakwa. That's my piece of land there. She told me this every morning during all my visits to convince me not to sell it. She said she would walk the 3 miles to the land and make sure the olive, almond, and fig trees were watered and the weeds were pulled out. At the end of the day, she would collect dry, dead tree branches, carry them home on her head in bundles, and store them in the basement for winter's fires. She dreamed that someday I would return to live in the village and would build myself a stone house on the hilltop land. She said, quote, "People would ask me every day why I was working so hard on that land, and I would tell them that I was taking care of it for you. I was so proud of it. I would talk to every blade of grass. I would talk to the trees and even the rocks and to the dirt and tell them about you, how you went so far away from your own people and how someday you would come back and live with us right here. I told the land and all its inhabitants, the worms and the rabbits, the birds and the snakes, never to forget you." Mother would often bring tears to my eyes when she would ask pathetically, "Have you forgotten us, son? Have you forgotten your land? Have you forgotten our good-smelling air and our pretty red poppies?"
That's so beautiful.
Thank you.
I love that. That's a poem.
Yes, it's a poem.
I think it's a poem.
That was Palestinian author Aziz Shehab and his poet daughter, Naomi, speaking together on the radio program Deep in the Heart from San Antonio, Texas. And that is our program this morning. You have been listening to This Week in Palestine, a segment of Truth and Justice Radio that emanates from WZBC 90.3 FM in Newton, Massachusetts. This is your host, John Roberts, inviting you to join us every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. And now wishing you a good morning.